Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today on the podcast with me, I have Anishka Prashad. We talked about immigrant versus founder challenges, flipping the idea of underrepresented founders to talk about underrepresented investors, creating a different face in venture, and the real customer's dilemma versus clicks on a website for today's founders. You're not going to want to miss this episode. Check it out. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, and we're in our new studio here today. Really excited to have with me Anishka Prashad. Anishka is the founder of Astra, a syndicate of inspiring and aspiring angel investors that showcases and invests in underrepresented and female founders. She is also the head of strategy and operations at Future VC, which provides internships and masterclasses to aspiring VCs from underrepresented backgrounds. Anishka, really great to have you here in the studio with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Amazing. Well, let's dive straight in. You know, we heard a little bit about your background on the primer, but let's delve a little bit deeper. You're a lawyer in New Zealand for the first 8 years of your career. How did you, or why did you make maybe that jump first from New Zealand to the UK and then from law to startups?
So thank you for that. I just want to clarify that 8 years was probably like a combination of a lot of things leading up to doing a clerkship, plus having practiced law, plus like sort of coming to the UK and doing a couple of jobs while I was bootstrapping my company.
Got it.
Otherwise people are going to have a completely different definition of how old I am, but that's all right. I essentially started off in litigation, and then I found myself in a weird space where I wasn't getting very excited with the job that I was doing, and I wasn't very excited with the future prospects of what it had in store for me. So I think personally I was very entrepreneurial, and I wanted to try out different businesses even while I was practicing law, for fun most of the time, helping out with people's ventures as well. So when the chance came to do an MBA, that's what sort of I got invited from Imperial College, and I took it up, that opportunity. I sat on a plane with a one-way ticket and I came here to explore my future, basically. And it's been a very unexpected, yet, you know, like, that's something that I kind of expected, put it this way. I wasn't expecting a walk in the park when I'm switching continents. So it was definitely something that that I probably wasn't prepared for, but like, you can't prepare for that anyway. So that's part of the thrill and excitement, right, of venturing into something you don't know.
Amazing. I mean, it's interesting. We had, and actually we were talking about this earlier, but we had Tara Louise Reddy on the podcast way back. She's actually our first guest on the podcast. And she had a similar journey in that she actually trained as a vet here in the UK and then moved to New Zealand to practice. And she was really getting frustrated and somewhat bored with, the slowness of the pace, which I'm sure in the legal industry, you know, that adoption of technology has been really slow. I would say accounting and finance and law are probably the areas where it has been relatively slow to kind of adopt. And similarly, she came back here, did her MBA, and then, you know, ended up working with Blipar and then launching her own business. So let's talk about that, because, you know, when you founded Resolve, which is, as you said, in the primary legal tech platform, back in 2019, I'm sure you faced a bunch of challenges, not least the fact that COVID was just around the corner, although you probably didn't know that at that time. So what were the sort of challenges that you faced? And I know you're really open about this, so.
Yeah, I suppose my challenges were like a couple of different sets of challenges. First of all, like immigrant challenges, and then founder challenges, right? And when you marry them up, you've got the perfect storm in certain ways to be able to learn, evolve, and grow around that. I'd want to call it that. So basically, I had solo founded a technology company, not knowing very much about technology at the time. So I was teaching myself how to code. I was literally trying to make sure that I knew everything in terms of having a conversation with the developers, to doing stakeholder management, to be able to raise capital. Drafted my own Innovate UK grant, because obviously I didn't come from money, so I didn't have the money to sort of like start a business on my own. I made sure that I, you know, exhausted everything in the book that you could have done within a couple of months of coming to the UK. So it was challenging, yes, but like, I think along the way, doors just opened up to be able to do it for 3 years, because I didn't necessarily have like a couple of months, a stint or, and then kind of abort the project. I went on for 3 years. We switched quite a few teams. The first group of people didn't work because talent hiring is not something that I did previously. In my previous job as a lawyer, I was used to managing people maybe to an extent and understanding stakeholder management, but hiring is a different skill altogether, especially if you're trying to hire for technology that you are yet to discover how it functions and things. And just to give you a context, I was trying to build a natural language processing platform, which requires AI and ML. And that's something that I was very new to. So hindsight now, it would have probably flown due to ChatGPT and its APIs that we could have benefited from. At that time, the technology wasn't there, simply. I basically kept on going with my own efforts to understand people. The space that we were in was quite challenging because of COVID. Post-Brexit as well, there was a talent exodus that kind of just left England. Whether you liked it or not, you were in it. When I was launching it, I had no idea of the challenges, but took it in my stride, kept going.
So there are a couple of things there that, you know, I think are very interesting in the context of kind of UK today. One of them is the Innovate UK grant, right? So you said you drafted your own grant. The reality is that what I found, having looked at this several times, both for myself and for other businesses that I worked with, it is challenging. And it is actually a process that requires a lot of time, a lot of effort, and quite often an inability to foresee. I mean, obviously, there's no guarantee that you will succeed when you apply for a grant, but often you won't get told if your grant application even meets the criteria for the grant itself, let alone whether you then receive the grant, until after you've submitted it. Was this a case of just basically rolling up your shirt sleeves and saying, I got to do this, I'm not going to pay, you know, one of the various kind of R&D grant funding organizations out there to write it for me? And you know, how was that process for you?
I mean, I couldn't afford to pay, right? Yeah. Like, it's a very unregulated market, grant writing. So you can have anything from like a couple of hundred to thousands.
Several thousand, yeah.
Several thousands plus succession fees as well. So, I mean, economically speaking, it doesn't make sense to get like a grant for 100,000 respectively and then paying 20K worth of fees for drafting it. So like, it just didn't make sense. So I drafted it. And to be honest, like for me, it was more of a learning process because I told myself, what's the worst that could happen from this process? I'll end up with a business plan. So yeah. I went into it with that approach rather than I will win this grant.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I definitely needed the capital to do what I was doing, but it wasn't something that I didn't put myself under that type of pressure that this is, you know, make or break. I just thought, right, I used to be a lawyer. I've got some drafting skills. Let's see if this thing works out. I suppose my skills as a lawyer did kind of put me in good stead to start drafting research. And I just kind of went through the whole process and was fortunate enough to get it.
And how, just out of interest, how long was that process?
So it was a prolonged process. I didn't, I kind of gave myself a month worth of drafting. And this wasn't like just sitting down in one room for a month, but it was like in between running a company, trying to get like, you know, your product up to speed as well, because you are talking about your product that you're supposedly wanting a grant for. So it was a combination of that. And I think the whole process would have taken me maybe a month. I did have a couple of consultants that gave me their sort of advice out of the goodness of their heart. And that's exactly what like I want to pay it forward. So nowadays, like I give people the same advice with their Innovate UK grants. Like, you know, I've drafted this before. I know what it's like. I know, you know, I've got an appendix template. Take it, you know, like I'm pretty open with it.
And post-drafting, like how long from submission to getting cash?
I think we were luckier because the fund that we had gone for in terms of applying for the grant was a sustainable fund grant. So it was a de minimis grant that was commissioned during COVID. Mm-hmm. And we're lucky in the sense that we didn't have to do match funding for it.
Got it.
So match funding is obviously a concept that you need to have 30% arranged and 70% gets deployed by Innovate UK, and then you kind of are on a roll. Because of the de minimis structure, we didn't need any outside investors. Mm-hmm. So we basically got the entire grant for exploitation, but then again the timing of it was kind of critical, right? Because you wouldn't necessarily get the money up front.
Yeah.
That's another thing with most grants, right? People don't realize that. You'd get it drip fed And
you've got a report on it.
And you've got a report on it. How you're spending it. You can't deviate from your initial plan because that's not something that Innovate UK would appreciate. And for very good reasons, but it's public money. So it needs full disclosure. In the middle of it all, if you've got like varying team needs, etc., it's up to you to be able to manage that, right? Like, and especially with a startup that's got no revenue, that can be quite challenging because most innovative companies, tech innovation companies, don't have revenue at that stage. So you'd have to use your resources as best you can, I would say. And I think a lot of founders struggle with it. So yeah, it is a badge of honor because it is tough to get one of those innovative.
But it's also, once you have it, it's tough to maintain.
Exploitation and deployment of capital is even more intense, put it this way, because you'd have to make sure that you've used public funding to the best of its extent. And it's been deployed for the right interest, and it aligns with the plan that you initially put in.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, actually, that whole point around public funding. There's been recently an article in The Guardian, 92 million of the 1.something billion deployed in the Future Fund has essentially had to have been written off because the business has gone bust. Actually, in reality, and obviously there was negative publicity about it, but when you look at that number, that's only 8% of the total funds deployed.
Yeah.
And actually it only takes, you know, one or two, you know, outliers to kind of return that capital that was invested. And I think with Innovate, much like R&D tax credits, much like the SEIS, EIS, it is about fostering that innovation and allowing people. And let's face it, most people, and you know, you yourself have said, you know, don't have family capital.
Yeah.
You didn't have family capital. You didn't have the means by which you could just launch this business. You didn't necessarily have a network of angels that you could go to. You know, yes, it is incumbent on you to report and spend that money, you know, in the right way, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think it's also incumbent on governments to make sure that, you know, that they are providing these sources of capital so that we can get innovative businesses off the ground. Because realistically speaking, you know, there is very likely some guy sitting on a council estate in, I don't know, Manchester, who probably, you know, given the means and given the opportunity, would launch a business, but doesn't know how, doesn't have the access, right? So I think it's important that these structures exist. And you were talking about teams, right?
Yeah.
And the difficulty. And I think any founder anywhere in the world, especially in the current environment where there are, you know, lots of teams being sadly laid off, lots of downsizing, right-sizing, and all of these wonderful words that consultants typically come up with. But, you know, your challenge was both, you know, firstly, the wrong team, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you said, this exodus of talent, which a lot of us have seen as well. Or if not just the exodus of talent, just far higher demand and competition for that talent. Right. Let's talk about, you know, the wrong team. What having gone through that experience, what would you have done differently? What were the things that you kind of didn't pick up on that you picked up on later?
I think human nature is to believe the best in people.
Yeah.
Right? Like when you're interviewing somebody, you would think, right, this person is telling me a true picture and depiction of their skills and capabilities, etc. But human nature is also to, when you're on the other side, to not be disclosing all of your skills. So I think sometimes there's a misalignment of things. And I mean, that's just a given in tech projects because they are ambitious, right? You're trying to do something that's disruptive, that hasn't been done before. And as a founder, I was very much prepared that at some point in time, I will have to scrap the entire team and deploy a new one. And I was pretty ready for it, but
and that might have happened either because you ran out of money for a period, or something else changed,
or just like the skills are not aligning. The skills are just not aligning. Right. For instance, if you're trying to build a platform that is AI heavy, right? You don't need just any software engineer. You need somebody who knows AI through and through. You need someone who knows machine learning, etc. Like, and I personally, all I knew was the definitions. I'm not a techie, right? So I could use Bubble. I could code on that, but that's a no code platform. So like there's a lot of things over there that you learn through the process. And to be honest, when you're recruiting, you are seeing stuff on CV and trying to match it with the person, right? And you match it and you do the best and you pray for the best. But it doesn't always happen. So when that happens and people have to part ways, the business still goes on. Because like the reality is that like 18 months into it, it didn't work out. And then after that, I had to get a new team. And I did. right? So from that perspective, I think as a founder, your head has to be switched on. It's a horse with almost like blinkers on, right? That this is what we need to do, especially if you've got public money to spend, right? So you have to give full disclosure of exactly what's happened and why your product is functional or not, etc. So, those are challenges that any founder would have, right? At some point, you're going to have to fire people. At some point, you're going to have to hire new people. So I think if you're not geared up to all of that, then entrepreneurship isn't for you.
It's the wrong place for
you. Yeah, it's the wrong place for you. You can't have beautiful conversations all the time. Like that's not the role of a founder or an angel investor or anyone who's in the startup land, right? Like they are difficult conversations. They are tough decisions and you need to make them.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree with you more. And some of those tough decisions, we'll talk about this a bit later when we talk about Astra maybe, is figuring out what differentiates you, why someone would want to work with you, why your product should exist, et cetera, et cetera. But let's talk about changing tack for a second. Like, how did you then make the transition from startups into VC, right? First with C Ventures. And were you specifically, when you joined C, were you looking for a firm focused on female founding teams? Because clearly that seems to be, well, certainly underrepresentation within the ecosystem seems to be really important to you.
Yeah. I was doing a role with C Ventures as a venture investments fellow purely out of interest. So it was at the same time that I was working for Future VC. And it's something that I've done, quite honestly, that I just want to learn a bit more about the kind of angel investing that everyone else is doing, not just myself, right? So it was more about just a pro bono sort of role that was voluntary that I kind of learned more skills from and, just maintain that connection going forward. Because I really do believe that we need more of them. We need more angel syndicates, and we definitely need more the right kinds of angel syndicates, right? So there's enough out there, I know that. But having that said, most of them don't really survive. And I think you need to know each other and to be able to help out with resources, whether it be deal flow, whether it be LPs, whether it be anyone in your connection that can make something happen for one of their portfolio companies. I think it is very much a community-focused thing, right? So you need to be able to do that. And I think that's what I learned from C Ventures, and I maintain that relationship going forward with them.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about Astra then, right?
Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about it in the primer and just now as well, but what really drove you to set up a separate angel network? Because, as you just said, there are multiple angel networks out there. There are certainly multiple female focused networks out there. We've had Agatina Wicker, we've had Emmy Faust, we've had Samira Ann Kasim from Pinksalt and various others on here, either with female focused funds or platforms or communities that are focused either on underrepresented or female founders specifically. So what then differentiates Astra from all of those?
I think we've got more of a lens on getting underrepresented investors rather than just having underrepresented founders getting funding. So first of all, very lovely names to hear, and I know of them personally. They're doing great jobs. So I think their focus is more about the female founders angle, whereas mm-hmm. I've been very clear that I identify more with the underrepresented and female founder. Mm-hmm. So the underrepresented could be anything. First of all, I'm an immigrant, right? So that's something that I think I strongly identify myself with. And I've seen a lot of founder friends who are immigrants who come to a new city, new country, etc., and basically build everything from scratch, life and a company and a network. So I've got a huge appreciation for those who are going out there and venturing in it. So when I'm sort of seeing angel investors in the network who are, have an aspiration to sort of be on the other side of the table, being the decision maker, not necessarily somebody who's asking for a check, because that's the light that I kind of see most underrepresented founders in, right? Most of the time it's oh, I'm an underrepresented founder and I'd love for you to back my company because of X, Y, and Z. I think the table has to be switched at some point where you're not just getting underrepresented founders getting funding, but also empowering those who are trying to get more knowledge and schooled up in angel investing so that there's a bit of an equilibrium that we're working towards, right? Because otherwise capital just gets deployed into one end, but the people deploying it are still not necessarily closely aligned to the pain point.
I think what's really interesting to me, you know, as you've been talking about, I've had this thesis for a long time, right? To get more diversity into the ecosystem, you have to start with more diverse LPs or angels funding more diverse VCs or those angels diverse, then funding diverse founding teams, which then exit and recycle that capital, right? So I think switching it on their head makes a lot of sense, right? Because you have to start with where the capital is rather than where the founder is, I think. And you know, I've heard from others, you know, off the record where they've been, you know, where they've raised, you know, a fund that is focused on underrepresented founders, and they then get told by LPs potentially that they won't invest. And the reason they won't invest is, hey, you're really great because, you know, you're underrepresented yourself and you're going to back underrepresented founders. But the next ticket at the next round, they're not diverse. They're not necessarily going to follow, you know, the money that you've put, you know, they're not going to necessarily walk the walk that you're walking, right? So I think thinking about it in terms of, you know, underrepresented investors is really important. And I think one of the things that probably, you know, you and I talked about this, coming from sort of Asian backgrounds, like the wisdom is that you build your wealth via property, right? Yeah. Rather than necessarily investments. I mean, yes, obviously people invest in the public markets and so on. I mean, I know a lot of Asian, Indian, African, West Indian people who are probably of decent levels of income or wealth, who probably have never considered investing in startups, right?
Yeah.
Because they either don't know the ecosystem, they don't understand kind of what drives them. So how does Astra help with that?
So we're basically providing educational webinars and meetups for people who are interested. And it's very casual. It's not something that you have to sign up to. It's not a course. You don't pay for it. It's free at this stage. But yeah, I mean, like, we're very willing to collaborate with VC funds, for instance. And we have a couple of collaborations coming up that educate you on various types of challenges that you're going to face as an angel investor. So the first person that we had was Andy Iam, and he's from the Angel Investing School. He gave a crash course on Angel Investing 101, which was very appreciated by the people who attended.
He'll be on the pod in a month or so. Yeah.
Awesome. No, he's great. He's amazing. Yeah. I really like him. So he basically went through a rough course, and I hope that people have signed up to his course as well. And basically, I think Astra is trying to just get people more recognized in the areas who are like, I'm exposed to the entire venture ecosystem, where I see a lot of people just giving knowledge for free. So initially, like, And I do that myself for free, right? So I think the key is collaboration over here with Astra, trying to educate people who are trying to get into angel investing. Because I know that when I was trying to get into it, it was quite difficult just because people don't see you as an angel investor, right? Because, oh, so you've been a founder. Okay, great. Like, you know, like maybe like I don't look like one, and maybe I don't necessarily want to look like one, right? Because I think angel investing is more about a thought process of understanding how a business works rather than being somebody who, you know, comes from money and potentially has access to capital regardless. So I think it's a combination of everything. And with my attempt for Astra is basically to educate people of the options that you have. This is a new asset class, basically, that people are now coming to recognize. But the reality is that angel investing has been going on for ages. The reason that they recognize this more as an asset class is because, like home ownership you mentioned, is maybe a bit more inaccessible to people. We've got a, you know, cost of living crisis. We've got a home crisis in house ownership crisis in the UK particularly, as well as everywhere else, I'm sure. But it's much harder to get onto the ladder now than ever before. And that shouldn't necessarily mean that your savings or your wealth is just, you know, not really growing in that period of time while you're waiting for the perfect opportunity, etc. Fundraising and investing can be diversified. So that's something that I'm trying to shed more light on.
Yeah, and I think the other point there is that a lot of investors that come from those underrepresented backgrounds, or I mean, even aspiring angels in general, and I would definitely include myself in that number, in that cohort. You know, we don't necessarily have hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of pounds or dollars of capital to deploy, right? So I write £1,000 checks on an infrequent basis because that's what I can do, because my capital is tied up in my businesses and you know, and my kids essentially, right? And so I think just, you know, even just allowing people to understand that actually today it is much easier to write those £1,000 checks, right? And in fact, often they are the most useful checks to a founder because, you know, to your earlier point, it's about people then giving back. You know, a lot of angels are willing to give their time, you know, their experience and their understanding and their skill set. But you know, a lot of people just don't realize that they can write that 1,000 check. And of course, that's made even easier today by this sort of syndication and syndicate platforms that we're seeing, like Odin, like Vauban, and then obviously we've had Crowdcube and Cedars as well. But look, let's switch tack again, right? So let's talk about Future VC.
Yeah.
So what is it? Who is it for? And why is it important?
Right, so Future VC is essentially an internship program, and we're trying to get more underrepresented people into venture capital, diverse people rather, into venture capital. So a VC has traditionally been quite an elitist industry to get into, and quite a small portion of the finance industry in general. Like, there's not very, it might be hyped to an extent where we hear a lot about venture capital, but the reality is, as a sector within finance, it's very small. And that means that there's lesser jobs to go around and there's lesser opportunities, but there's huge demand, right? So part of Future VC's mission is to educate people who might not come from the obvious backgrounds to become a VC, but definitely have the skill sets, have the aspirations, and can definitely be on par with those if they were recruited into a VC fund.
And I mean, out of interest, right? Because, you know, again, there's a number of these out there. We've had Elena Kay from Newton before, and obviously you and I both know Nikita Thakra from Included. So it strikes me exactly to your point, right? It is a really small ecosystem, and therefore the likelihood of any one person finding their way into that ecosystem is narrow to start with, right? Because you're up against a lot of competition.
Yeah.
And then you're up against a lot of competition for a very small number of roles. So how do you guys kind of think about what success looks like, both for Future VC, but also for those interns?
I think Future VC is a little bit, first of all, great job to all those people that you mentioned. We definitely are friends and we like to work together. Future VC has a unique selling point that it's linked and attached to Diversity VC. So essentially, Diversity VC is a standard that helps people, VC funds, to understand if their fund is running diversely, etc. And it's basically an aspiration to, you know, like, be able to hold yourself accountable as a fund. And I think that's the unique selling point for Future VC, because we're an internship, basically a practical solution to an ideology. And that's not something that's kind of divorced from each other. It's very married, right? So most of the funds that we have that come on board Future VC are Diversity VC standard prescribers. And they basically are those who support the mission and want to see a different face in venture. So I think in that respect, Future VC is slightly different compared to the other ones that you've mentioned. And I don't think I see it as a competitor space at all. I think because of the market need being so crucial for getting more diverse people into venture capital and access to funding, I think we all need to work together to shift the dial. And there is an equity bias, right? There's basically like a lot of gaps to be filled. There's generational wealth that's been pumped into certain types of profiles. And I think that needs to be diversified for most VCs to be coming from any part of the world and to be able to get like that sort of access to education, that sort of access to opportunity, essentially. So that's all that we are doing. I think we're all trying to just create opportunity for people who hadn't had a taste of venture, but definitely have the skills and compatibility and competence to do it.
Yeah, no, look, that makes a lot of sense. And look, just before we wrap up, obviously, you know, this podcast, it's called Nothing Ventured for a reason, right? It's about backing yourself. It's about taking those first steps. Back in Jan of this year, you did a blog about lessons from 2022, as well as some of your predictions, as well as speculations for 2023. You know, including all the noise around generative AI and so on. But in light of tighter funding in the market generally and the explosion of generative AI, what advice do you have for people that are trying to get into the venture ecosystem, who are embarking on that journey for the first time, either as a founder or as an investor? What advice would you give to them?
I think it'd be different advice for the founder versus the investor. So like from a founder lens, it's no longer easy to just get capital based on a prototype, right? Like, it's something that I think most investors have caught on to, and you need to prove traction beyond like how many visits or clicks on a website. You need to be able to have real customers. And I think you need to be able to sort of demonstrate that this product is more than a prototype and more than just a pilot, et cetera. So I think from a founder perspective, they're having to prove more to be able to get access to the same capital that was pretty easily accessible in 2021. From an investor perspective, it's definitely, I think it's good because they're not just pouring money into something that they haven't done enough due diligence in. I think it's an intensified version of VC and investing in the funding landscape that we've been seeing in the past couple of years. Nonetheless, very informed, right? So it's properly assuring that capital's going to the right places and not necessarily just into the hype of things. I think it's a more sort of like a credible ecosystem.
Yeah, thoughtful
now.
At the moment.
I think people actually are thinking about what they're building and what they're helping to build, which is quite refreshing, to be honest. Because like now, when you see most angels or VCs sort of writing checks, the due diligence processes are longer. Equally, founders are aware that they have more to prove before they're able to get that access to capital. Right. So I think all in all, it's a good improvement. It's a shift in the right direction.
Yeah. Shift in the right direction doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be easier. But what I hope as you say, what I hope will happen is we will have better businesses backed by better investors, essentially.
Yeah. Informed investors. Right. And exactly. Informed founders, basically.
Yeah. Anishka, it's been absolutely incredible having you here with me today. For our listeners, if they're looking for you online, where's the best place for them to find you? On LinkedIn, Twitter, where can they look out for you?
I think LinkedIn's probably the best place to find me. I don't have enough to say on Twitter, so yeah, I can't say punchy things, but I'm usually pretty active on LinkedIn, so please find me there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much.